Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Local governments are spending the late fall months crafting their budgets for 2014. In a few weeks, La Crosse City and County officials will get the public's input on the financial plans. But here to talk about the proposed budgets today are La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot and La Crosse County Administrator Steve O'Malley. Mayor Cabot, this is your first budget that you've worked through. Steve, you have done many of these. I'm wondering if you could just first talk about the philosophy or the approach that you take. Steve, maybe just starting out since you've done this 11 times so far.
Well, our budget is really a team approach with the entire group of county departments. It's very staff-driven in that the county board trusts the processes that we've used previously to identify the highest priorities that are involved, what our choices are. And as a team, we work together to try to balance out the needs between departments. Previously in other county systems, committees would drive the process, and then you have conflicts between priorities, whereas I try to balance out priorities across departments, and one year this department may need a large expenditure. Another one has to wait for a couple of years while we deal with that first one. So it's very much a team approach, and we're only able to accomplish what we do because the department heads buy into it, and so does the county board.
And Mayor, how did you approach your first budget?
Well, that sounds very similar to the experience that I had with the first budget at the city. We rely on our departments and our department heads especially to be creative and prioritize and come together with the spending plan for the city. As you may know, the city has at times gone back and forth between an executive budget that the mayor's prepared and then the council preparing a budget through the Board of Estimates. This year, it started really as the Board of Estimates process, but it kind of morphed into a quasi-city executive budget because the Board of Estimates directed the mayor, directed me to say, well, why don't you work with the departments, put together the package, and then come back to us. And that's in essence what we did. And basically how Steve described it, working with the departments is how we approached it.
So before we dive into some of the details, I have to ask, financially, how are the budgets this year, Mayor?
I think we have a very good budget that we've put together. The city has been, way before my time, working very hard to have a very healthy city, especially from an operational standpoint. Over the last several years, the council and former mayors, they've put together policies that, affect things like our reserve fund, which we have a reserve fund, sort of that rainy day fund. And then just our approach this year, especially because of the state levy limits, we're pretty limited as far as, what we can do. It's unfortunate, but we start our process by saying, well, now what do we need to cut to just basically maintain our spending? So all that said, we have a very good budget because generally we are looking to provide our employees with a 3% wage increase, which it's been several years, and I felt that was a high priority that we really needed to do that. And then also we were able to add 3 community police officers as part of this budget as well. So that part of it has been a very good positive thing.
And Steve, how's the county looking? Are they in a good position?
I think we're in a real positive position, but this has been one of the most difficult years that we've done for many years. After 3 years in a row of no increase in property tax levy for anything other than debt service, it just really can't be sustained. And so we're going into this new year with a number of increases in cost throughout the budget, as well as the uncertainty of dealing with labor relations in the new year, where collective bargaining is still preserved for our deputies, but not for other employees. And so we're having to provide for what-if scenarios happen in the future as far as that bargaining relationship and the very difficulties that Act 10 actually imposed on local government in how we relate to and treat all employees as fairly as possible. So that's put us in a very difficult position.
So are you still feeling – you are still feeling the effects of that?
Certainly. We've got one group of employees that by law are treated much differently than others, preserve right to full collective bargaining and interest arbitration, which means all disputes go on to an independent arbitrator, while the majority of our employees in all of the departments then do not have the right to that and can only bargain on wages. So it's really set up a system of haves and have-nots and puts us in a very difficult position because historically we've gotten voluntary agreements. All employees settle for basically the same terms and conditions, and we've got a long history of that. So the legislative action in Act 10 really changed that dynamic, and it's unfair to most of our employees.
So let's talk about some of the things that are maybe new this year in the budgets. Steve, maybe let's talk about the county's budget. I know there's a handful of different things, but maybe what sticks out to you the most?
Large capital decisions that the county board are going to have to make in relation to replacing or remodeling the administrative center, Lakeview campus, a number of major facility decisions that are going on there with a 50-bed nursing home replacement, two 15-bed CBRF, community-based residential facilities, and a 10-bed nursing home, all on a different campus just adjacent to the existing campus. So major capital decisions. And then, of course, our road funding continues to be a huge challenge. Inflation just exceeds our ability to raise property tax levy to pay for roads. And unfortunately, over 83% of what we spend on roads locally for a county road system is direct property tax support. So it's the residences and businesses in the villages and the cities that are really supporting the road system. And so that really puts us into a real difficult bind in how much we can keep up with unmet road needs. At $70 million of unmet road needs right now that we've identified, we're just unable to meet that demand.
So will, you know, people living in La Crosse County with these different issues with the highway department and with road needs, as you talked about, I mean, are people noticing these differences and will they notice any changes next year?
Really, we're just hoping to hold the line. If we can continue to do about $3 million worth of borrowing a year for roads at the existing level of expenses and then somehow maintain with that inflation into the future, we'll be able to maintain the current level of roads. We won't see a lot of improvement. But to not lose ground when in the last 10 years we've seen well over 70% increase in the inflationary cost of materials, seal coating, oil, transportation costs, it's very difficult to keep up with that when property taxes are expected to be held even or flat.
And I see that the county health department could phase out home health care services. Could you talk about why that could be an option and maybe the effects that could roll out from that?
Well, this has been a long time direction that's been happening since 2000 when we were serving hundreds of people in home health. We're the only provider with an operating budget over $1.5 million to today where the operating budget for home health is under $400,000. And it's subsidized by property tax levy, and we're one of only eight counties or nine counties in the state that still provide the service. So staff, myself, and the department have recommended phasing this service out because we can no longer justify subsidizing with property tax. There are other providers in the business now that are able to do it more cost-effectively. Unfortunately, home health services is an undervalued service within the medical system, and the question is whether or not property taxpayers ought to be providing for that service for less than 30 clients a year. So it's really a difficult choice for the county. It will be controversial. Our board will be debating that over the next month. But we continue to recommend that we phase it out, find other placements for these clients, find other employment for the employees that are currently providing that service within our two institutions, Lakeview or Hillview. And these are always difficult decisions, but it's been a long time coming over the last 14 years.
And the property tax issue, I understand it could go up slightly?
It can go up slightly because of underutilized property tax levy previously, as well as the rate limit or the debt limit is the property tax limit is tied to the value of new construction, which we had a fairly modest growth of 1.29%. So that's actually the limit that we have.
And it could be about 9 cents. Is that per
about 9 cents on our tax rate is okay. What we've estimated.
Okay. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the La Crosse city and county budgets. My guests are La Crosse County Administrator Steve O'Malley and La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot. Mayor Cabot, let's talk a bit about the city budget. Maybe what are some of the things that stick out to you? I know you mentioned the 3% salary increase for employees. Why now? Why is that a good time for this?
As Steve O'Malley had mentioned regarding Act 10 and the negotiations, we are fortunate in the city. We, you know, basically have just come to agreement with our fire union, the fire department union, as well as the police and the non-supervisory police unions as well. And so, you know, in essence, they had set the threshold at the 3%, and I felt a 3% increase for 2014. I felt it was really important, as Steve was talking about, to treat all of our employees as, you know, equally as we possibly can. So that was an early goal as a part of our budget process, was to recognize that and to make that, you know, come to fruition with this budget for the other employees. So that is a big priority. As a part of the Act 10, there is still a lot of uncertainty, but one of the things we are moving forward with is a pay and classification study. You know, we hired Springstead, which is one of our financial advisors, to go through all of our staff positions and basically compare them to other cities and then compare them to the, you know, the larger market. And we've got money budgeted for that as well, because that will result in some adjustments to various departments within the city. So that was a big part of the focus. Again, I think, you know, in order to have good, creative employees, you've got to reward them. And that was something that we set out early on in the budget.
So do you have to find savings elsewhere in the budget to make this happen?
Or? We did. We started off, you know, right with the process right away of about, and I forget the exact number, but it was probably close to $900,000 of cuts that we needed to make just to maintain our, you know, our levy as it was last year, in essence. And so we looked at a number of positions. There were, you know, several positions that we ended up eliminating from the budget because they were, you know, either reorganized or they have been, you know, vacant for a period of time. And it's one of those situations where, again, as working with all the departments, trying to look at how we provide services, there were a couple of positions that we eliminated. And then there were other savings. One of the things that we saw was the duty disability insurance payments, and our premiums went down considerably as a part of the police. And that resulted in a very significant savings that the city was able to then, you know, basically work on these other priorities. And then there are a few other areas. We, you know, part of what I've really been trying to work with our staff on is the notion of, let's look for unspent monies or monies that had been borrowed in the past that were either carryover or, you know, were identified with projects that, you know, either the projects were done and money was saved, or the projects just aren't going to be completed. And so we did that, and we realized some carryover funds of about almost $150,000. And then, you know, there were just other savings. Again, each department came in and really looked at their individual line items. So we ended up, you know, the goal was to hold the line, and we're basically keeping the mill rate the same for 2014 as it is for this year. We actually have a little bit of capacity for net new construction. Our levy is going to be, you know, roughly $34.7 million that we're looking as far as our tax. We could go up to $34.8 million based on the net new construction, but I basically went to our departments and said, we want to keep the mill rate the same, especially in light of the fact that we do understand, again, you know, on the side of our other jurisdictions, we've had some referendums. Our school district and Western Technical College have had referendums that have passed, which are all great projects, but those are obviously going to have an impact for people when it comes to their property tax bill that they see here in another couple months. So we felt like if we can hold the line at this time in the city, that we should really try to do that. And then the other part of it is that with the slow economic recovery that we're seeing, you know, nationally in the state and locally, we know that there are people that are still, you know, struggling as far as paying their bills. So we felt that was, if we were able to do it, we really looked to do that. And so I'm happy to say that we are going to hold the line on the mill rate, at least in the budget as proposed.
And we've heard a lot about community policing in La Crosse.
Yes.
It's been kind of hard to see the results of all those talks, but you talked about how you hope to hire 3 new community police officers. Can you explain what exactly that means and maybe changes within the department if these 3 officers come on board?
Yes, we have currently 93 uniformed officers in the city. A few years ago, we actually had 99 officers. So the police, you know, through again, just holding the line and the kind of the reality that we live in, have reduced our police force. The police chief, our new police chief, has a vision for community policing. If he is able to actually, you know, get back up to the 99 officers, that those 6 officers would be the traditional community police officers, which, you know, I think for those that think about a beat cop, somebody walking a beat, you know, a officer out in the neighborhood, getting to know the residents, the businesses that are there. And that's what really the vision that we have for these 3 new officers. We're still working with a lot of our community partners to see if we could fund the 3 additional officers, because we were able to fund these 3 in the budget right now through federal grant and through local matches from our larger institutions. So right now, Viterbo University and Mayo Clinic have stepped up to help us provide the local match. And so the idea is 2 of those officers are going to be really stationed in that neighborhood, that Washburn, Powell Pogue, Hamilton neighborhood. They'll have, you know, the hospitals actually offered some space where they could, you know, again, check in, do their reports, have a base of operations, and they're going to spend the majority of their time in that neighborhood. The chief would like to see, you know, of the 6, 2 in that south side neighborhood area, 2 kind of in the downtown campus area, and then 2 on the north side. In the, you know, the really, again, getting into the neighborhood and getting to know the neighbors. And it's going to be, we have it funded for 3 years as a part of our federal monies. We've got to commit to a 4th year, and we're working on the funding actually for that 4th year. So I feel real good about the fact that we'll have these officers in place, at least 3 out of the 6. I'm hoping that we could still actually get the other 3 funded for next year in the neighborhoods. And, you know, a big part of what we're, you know, what we have to do is show the results of that. I mean, we've got to show that they're effective. I believe that they will be, but we want to make sure, you know, with our funding partners that we have demonstrable results for those efforts.
And of course, another thing that some people are very passionate about is the South Community Library. If this budget's passed, you found funding to finance it for another year, but beyond that, we don't know what's going to happen. How did you find the savings? I see that there have been some jobs eliminated, but there's some jobs that have been created for the library as a whole. So can you talk a bit about that?
The library is a little bit unique because they have, through the state, you know, they have the statutory authority where they, the city provides them with a funding each year, but then it's really up to them as far as how that funding is implemented. So it makes for, you know, it makes it just a little bit more challenging at times, especially when you're trying to find savings and all that. But the library board is dipping into their reserve funds. They do have a reserve account. We asked them, you know, with the pledge that we want to get together as a community and look at a more long-term sustainable funding model. And that's really what we're going to do. We were able to find some additional savings in the city budget. So our contribution, the city contribution went up, you know, only $26,000, but, you know, every bit helps. And the library board dipped into their reserves a little bit more to basically, you know, bridge that difference. And then what I'm hoping to do is by the end of this year, put together a community task force that will look at the branch libraries, because they are very vital pieces to our neighborhoods, and figure out a way to staff those. Reaching out to La Crosse County, reaching out to the school district, reaching out to our nonprofits and our neighborhood groups. Maybe there's some other players involved as well, but to look at the opportunity, again, to keep those centers open. And it wouldn't necessarily always, I guess it's a little bit different than sort of your traditional library. Maybe there's, you know, park and rec programs that could be run out of the branch libraries. Maybe there are senior centers. You know, we have both a north side and south side senior center in addition to our community centers. So maybe there's opportunities there to consolidate some of those programs and, you know, provide the staffing so that those can remain open and be important pieces of those neighborhoods.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. My guests today are La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot and La Crosse County Administrator Steve O'Malley. We're talking about the city and county's budgets. The two of you talked a bit about Act 10 and the effect that that's been having on your employees. But have there been any other impacts of the state and federal budgets on your city and county budgets? Steve, would you like to talk maybe about the county first?
Certainly, in a number of areas, the threat of the government shutdown really impacts county government because only 20% of our entire budget is supported by local property tax. We're a complex organization of a mix of federal, state, user fees, and depending upon the service, it's tied to very specific mandates and very specific directions by the federal or state government. So it's a layered effect of various impacts. So we are tied to what they require us to do, and a lot of our choices are limited to that. So certainly we watch that with a great deal of interest. The fact that they've only extended the federal government to, what, January 15th really doesn't provide a lot of certainty. Some of the sequester cuts actually impacted directly our aging programs, our nutrition sites. So again, it's unclear what the state and federal government really want local government to do, and long term we watch that a great deal. However, the battle between the state and federal government on the Affordable Care Act has really sent a lot of mixed messages. The state, by avoiding receiving the Medicaid funding that most logical states are pursued to actually expand affordable care to people that need it, our state bypassed the money and then is passing additional money on to counties to try to help navigate people through the system as they're dumped from Badger Care to try to get on the Affordable Care Act. So on the one hand, they're not providing enough funding that they could to provide direct care, but they're sending money to counties to hire additional staff to actually navigate people through the system. So we're adding additional staff at a time where other programs aren't able to in order to back up the political policy decision that the state government has imposed. So it's a very complicated issue to explain to most people, but very contradictory in understanding the policy debate between the federal government and our state.
And I was wondering, with the Walker administration's recent decision to cut property taxes by $100 million, which I believe for a single homeowner, that's about $13 just in this first year, does that have any effect on the city or the county at all?
Not on any of our revenue sources that I'm aware of. I believe it's through the school tax credit process, but we haven't seen an increase in shared revenue from the state on the direct property taxes or really in much of any significant area in human services, youth aids, court aids. The state has basically passed all inflationary costs back to the county, with the only exception is that, of course, Act 10 allowed us in 1 year to make up some of that by imposing Wisconsin retirement contribution on our employees. But again, that's a one-time item. You don't get that savings every year because it's already in your base budget. And sometimes I don't think the state recognizes that.
Mayor Cabot, what about the city of La Crosse?
We've actually received decreases in both our expenditure restraint payment. That was a decrease of almost $100,000. And then our transportation aids were also cut on top of what we were already expecting. So, you know, over the course of the last several years, we have seen the state share of our overall budget, which is about $71 million, be reduced. So we're, again, looking to make that up, obviously, locally. And that's where some of the fees and some of those things have come into play. And those, of course, are not very popular with folks. But it's because of the reductions from the state that we're, you know, having to face. And, you know, we, again, the $100 million tax cut doesn't really have an impact to us either. Part of the concern, of course, is the state still faces a structural deficit out into the future. And if they are providing property tax relief now, that's you know, their decision. But what happens, you know, 2-3 years down the road, will we be facing another situation where we'll see drastic reductions to our shared revenue, which again will have big implications here for the city?
The thing I should be very positive about, though, is that unlike Mayor Cabot talked about the change in general transportation aids, we've seen a significant increase in general transportation aids for county maintenance of state roads. And so probably the largest increase we've ever seen is in this past budget. And it won't help directly our county road system, but the maintenance that county maintenance workers does to state roads is a huge improvement, as well as while we're dealing with all the construction, we're very lucky as a region to be seeing the type of investment in our interstate road system that we're seeing with the Dresbach Bridge, with the entire interstate system. If people notice the amount of overlay and work that's going on the interstate system, Exit 3 interchange over the next several years, and our highway commissioner has been very successful in competing for state grants for safety and other improvement projects, the very positive note is that while that doesn't help the county road system or the city road system, each one of those areas really significantly expands the confidence and structure and quality of our area infrastructure. We're very lucky in that sense that while much of the state's capital investment has been going to the Milwaukee area, we've been very successful as a region, and people should recognize that this administration, while we differ many times on a lot of the issues we've talked about, we've been successful in this region in getting some infrastructure dollars that are vitally needed.
Mayor Cabot, before you mentioned fee increases in this new budget, will residents see increases in user fees and whatnot?
No, that's one of the positives with this budget. We're not, at this point at least, tapping into any of our reserve funds to balance the budget, and we are not proposing any increases in fees outside of, and I should be very careful, of course, because there are a few fee proposals when it relates to our outdoor beer gardens, and I believe there's a few others that are facing a slight increase. I think they're, most cases it's a $10 increase based on a $150 or $200 license over 2 years. So it is a slight increase. But the vast majority of how we've addressed the budget, is not looking at increases in any of our utility rates. So our water and sewer rates will stay the same, which, again, all add up for a homeowner.
And is it the same for the county?
Very similar for user fees. We do an entire catalog for the whole county board of all of our user fees. There's some slight changes in some small areas of 2, 3%, but very, very small, limited impact on the budget itself. The board debates that, and unless there's enough justification that there's been a significant increase in cost, we don't try to balance things out based on user fees, but we do expect that users to pay for the full cost of the service that they provide, because if you have a choice of whether or not to pick a service, you should be paying for that rather than the general property taxpayer. So it's very consistent with our philosophy, but we haven't been shifting a lot of cost to user fees.
Steve O'Malley is the La Crosse County Administrator, and Tim Cabot is the La Crosse Mayor. They were talking about the city and county budgets. The public hearing for the county budget is November 12th, and the public hearing for the city's budget is November 19th. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk with the co-author of a recent study that examines tax incremental finance, or TIF, districts in the area. Archives of this and other recent editions of Newsmakers, extended interviews, photos, and links to the budgets can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Like us at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Tax incremental finance districts are a tool in the economic development belt of local municipalities, but they've also been a source of criticism in recent years, especially in the city of La Crosse, where TIF opponents have argued there are too many, and as a result, they're bad for the average property taxpayer. UW La Crosse and UW Extension recently did a study of the impact of TIF districts in the greater La Crosse area. Our guest is the study's lead author, UW La Crosse political science professor John Cavari. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis first asked him for the definition of a TIF district.
The way a tax incremental finance district works, or a TIF works, is that a local community can use this financing tool to help support real estate development in their communities. So if there's a rundown property or if there's development that's that they want to occur, they'll use TIF as a way to help spur real estate development or property development there. And the way that TIF works is kind of the interesting part. Basically, what these communities will do is they'll freeze the property tax base, so they'll freeze property values, and all new development that is generated after the investment goes to pay off that investment. So it's new property taxes that are paying off that investment into the TIF.
The basic idea is the city can borrow money and make improvements, street improvements, water and sewer improvements, and the hope is to spur new development in the area.
That's absolutely right. The goal is to increase property values, to convert perhaps a blighted property into something that's productive for the community overall.
Do most TIFs actually work that way?
This is the fun part of TIF, is that there are two sides, and TIF can be an extremely beneficial economic development tool. It can raise property values dramatically, but on the other hand, it's a risky tool, and if property values don't increase, like we saw during the Great Recession, that can put a strain on local budgets too.
How so?
If a city is going to borrow to invest in any given real estate development, the city has to repay that debt. And if the property values aren't going up in that district, the city's got to find other ways to refinance that debt. And that could come from either cutting existing services, that could come from increasing taxes, it could mean borrowing from other revenue-generating sources like utilities within the municipality. So there are a variety of options to deal with it, but it could still put a strain on the local budget.
Your study is a much more broad view of what's going on in the greater La Crosse area. A lot of communities are using at least one of these.
What we wanted to do was put La Crosse's TIF use in perspective with other communities. So we didn't just want to look at the city of La Crosse. We wanted to look at TIF in the greater La Crosse region. So we looked at a few other counties and a few comparable cities, cities that are similar in size to La Crosse. So, yeah, to start out, the city of La Crosse has increased its TIF use over the past, say, 10 to 20 years. So its TIF utilization rate, which is a measure that we like to use and look at how much TIF is actually being utilized in a community, that TIF rate has increased from TIF utilization rate of 5% in 2000 to just over 8% in 2012. So that TIF now covers a vast majority of downtown La Crosse. Comparably with other cities like Sheboygan or Oshkosh or Wausau, La Crosse is kind of in that range. So it's not – there's three levels. There's a low range, medium range, and a high range. I think La Crosse's TIF utilization rate is right between that medium and high range.
Is there a cap that municipalities, they can't exceed a certain percentage of their property value as a TIF?
That's right. So the state puts a limit on how much property value can actually exist in TIF districts, and that cap is 12%. So 12% of the community, if the TIF amount exceeds 12%, that community can no longer pursue TIF. So it's not – a lot of communities actually exceed that 12% cap. What that cap means is that those communities can't pursue TIF anymore.
Could you describe a TIF that has gone well or worked well?
Sure. So there's a really a good example in downtown La Crosse, the Pump House, which is that art gallery downtown. And there's a TIF district there that has really – generated some fantastic returns, increased property value. So in 1992, TIF number 5 along Front and King Streets was valued at about $890,000 in 1992. Now, in 2012, that same district is valued at over $8.5 million. So that return is pretty dramatic. To increase that, the property values there is pretty it's fantastic. So, and it really helps out other homeowners in the city.
That has been where the expansion of the large office buildings has been for Logistics Health and other companies down there.
That's correct. And I think it might encompass the Marriott as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And what did the city have to invest to get that return?
Ooh, gosh, I don't know. You know, my co-authors, Ryan Hutter and Carl Green from the UW Extension offices, have a really good grasp of those, the details of these individual TIFs. They would be helpful here.
The other side of the coin, describe a TIF that hasn't worked real well, either in the city of La Crosse or elsewhere that you came up with in the study.
Well, I think a really good example is the village of Warrens. So Warrens is where the Jellystone campground is, and this was a massive investment by the village of Warrens, and initially it paid off very well. The property value decreased from a high of $90 million in 2008 to that value was cut in half to $45 million in 2012, so it was really affected by the Great Recession. So the economic turmoil that we went through, the overall decrease in housing values across the country really hit Warrens hard. And, they're hoping that new property value would help pay off the initial investment into Jellystone. So that's lagging a little bit, but I think they'll rebound a little bit there.
Statewide, what is the use of TIFs like? Are communities using TIFs?
TIF is now the most widely used economic development tool by local governments. It's growing dramatically. It's grown about 40% over the past 10, 12 years, since about 2000. So it's expanding in its use, and the state is allowing for more and more opportunities for communities to utilize TIF, including towns. Towns were previously not allowed to use TIF, but they are allowing that for towns now.
Is there a reason we've seen this expansion in TIF use?
Well, I think there are a lot of success stories. You know, there again, the two sides of TIF. Property values have been going up during the 1990s and the 2000s, and it's been successful. It hasn't put a lot of strain on local budgets at all. And I think a lot of communities are seeing success stories, how these rundown, blighted properties can turn into something that's beneficial and adding to the tax base.
Is it used primarily for that, for the blighted property, or are suburbs that have a lot of land and can grow that way using TIFs as well?
And they can, and that's one of the concerns that we've highlighted in our report, is that TIF is now being used in a way that wasn't originally intended. So it's gone from being an economic redevelopment tool to being an economic development tool. So just for straight economic development, developing on otherwise natural green space or agricultural land and converting that into neighborhood developments.
Is there a concern with that?
Well, the concern is that if communities are going to use TIF for these expansive developments, these brand new developments on green space, that they won't have the economic benefits and spillover effects that these other TIF districts would, that are kind of closely surrounded by other properties. We want TIF to have benefits that spill over to the surrounding area. And if a TIF district is isolated, say on some open green space at the end of a highway, they might not have the spillover effects that TIF was intended. And TIF really should be used to redevelop these problematic properties. We don't want to skew the market so that we're just creating even cheaper land for real estate developers necessarily. But the purpose of TIF is really – the original purpose of TIF is really to redevelop these blighted properties.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with UW La Crosse political science professor John Kabari. He helped author a report that analyzes tax incremental financing in the greater La Crosse area. I know the TIF law in Wisconsin was created in the mid-70s.
Right.
And we've seen an expansion of it in the last 20 years.
Right.
Can we tie anything to that? I know local budgets have not been getting as much support from the state government in the last 20 years. Is there a direct correlation there?
part of the concern with the Wisconsin statute is this definition of what a blighted property actually is, or a blighted series of properties actually is. It's fairly ambiguous. A blighted property could be just about anything that a local community wants it to be blighted. So the definition of blighted is stretched in Wisconsin in comparison to Minnesota. In Minnesota, the law is very specific, meaning that a blighted property has to be at least 50% developed or have structural deficiencies on that property. So I think we could learn a little bit from the Minnesota law in applying TIF here in Wisconsin.
So there have been changes recently to Wisconsin's law. What have they involved?
There are two specific changes to the TIF statute. One is to extend the life duration of a TIF district. I think if these districts are stressed, they can expand the life out to, I think, a maximum of 33 years or so. Another is to be able to create what's known as a mixed-use tax incremental finance district that eliminates that blight requirement in the statute if there's a mixed-use development, so a mix of industrial, commercial, and residential development. So it's a more complex version of the original TIF, and it's been used in Wisconsin with greater frequency.
There was also, within the last year or year plus, in the city of La Crosse, this notion of the reverse TIF
right.
came up in relation to a property that QuickTrip was trying to develop. What is a reverse TIF?
Well, a reverse TIF can go by a lot of different names, but the way I like to refer to a reverse TIF is that a developer, instead of the city incurring the debt, and I'm not sure if this applies to the QuickTrip development or not, but the way we like to refer to a reverse TIF is that instead of a city taking on that initial debt, a developer will actually take on that initial debt. And the new property taxes will go to pay off the debt that the developer incurs. So it's a way to limit the liability that a city uses.
Are there positives and negatives to that?
Because TIF has risk inherently involved, whenever a city is going to or a village is going to incur debt, you want to minimize the liability. You want to allow for the repayment of that investment. So to put the burden on the real estate developer instead of the municipality, I think, is, you know, a creative use of TIF. And in the report, we want to encourage the creative use of TIF.
You mentioned Minnesota's law and how it's a little different. Do most states have a tax incremental financing law or something similar?
Yeah, and, you know, all the states are different. Now, I think 49 states now allow for TIF, and I forget who the exception is, but it's very widely used now, and each state is going to be a little different. The Wisconsin statute has two really important requirements for a basic TIF. The TIF needs to be applied to blighted properties, and the TIF needs to occur, or the real estate investment needs to occur but for the TIF, or could not happen but for the TIF, meaning the but for, you know, test is an interesting test. It's a little bit of a logical, you know, puzzle. Basically, what it means is that the TIF can't happen unless the real estate development wouldn't happen but for the TIF. So the real estate wouldn't happen unless there's TIF support there. But that can be stretched too. You know, it's a little bit of a word salad there, but those are the two main requirements, the blight designation and the but-for test.
One of the most common criticisms or complaints of TIFs that I've heard over the years is that if you have a lot of them, like the city of La Crosse does, if they aren't producing the tax revenue or the tax base that they're projected to create, that the average homeowner is going to suffer as a result of that. Is that a valid argument?
You know, I think there is some concern that, you know, some communities could be using TIF too much or over-TIFing. And I think there's some valid concern there. We want to make sure that our elected officials are using these financial strategies in a prudent way, in a way that's not going to hurt property taxpayers or residents. Now, the thing with TIF is that, you know, if a TIF isn't performing the way it should be, there are a lot of strategies that public officials can use to minimize the risk or the impact on the average resident in the community or the average property tax payer. So, you know, these elected officials, if a TIF isn't working well, can, you know, perhaps cut services, restructure the debt. They could, you know, hopefully not increase taxes, or they could borrow from utilities, other revenue-generating sources to help pay that TIF off. Now they can extend the life of the TIF as well. So there are a lot of tools to help minimize that risk. The other concern is that, you know, using TIF is somehow hurting other taxing entities like the school district or the county government or TC, Western Technical College District. I'm not sure if that criticism necessarily holds, because the TIF is there to help out those taxing entities down the road as well.
If I recall, they also have a say. The school district does, the Western Technical College does, the county has a say on whether a TIF district can happen or not, doesn't it?
Right. There's an extra process. The city of La Crosse, for example, can't just snap their fingers and say, we want to use TIF. Every TIF proposal has to go through what's known as a joint review board process, so that all the other taxing entities that would be affected by a TIF have a say. So La Crosse County would have a say, La Crosse School District would have a say, and TC would also have a say in that. Mm. So they've got to give the thumbs up in order for this TIF to actually occur.
Could a successful TIF help pay for other not as successful TIFs that aren't making their return on investment?
Yeah, so there's a new caveat in the TIF law that says that a successful TIF, revenue from a successful TIF, if property values are growing in that front in King Street area, that revenue can be used to help pay off a TIF that's not doing as well. And that's happening here in La Crosse. It's not to any great extent where it's worrisome. But, you know, it could be a smart strategy. I think the Village of Holman is considering using the strategy now. The village administrator there is looking at ways to help one of its struggling TIFs out. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's wise, you know, fiscal management.
Why do this report?
From an academic standpoint, you know, from my standpoint, it's really interesting to study because it is so widely used now. And I teach a class at UWL, Urban Administration, and I teach budgeting classes where we can analyze this this tool, this TIF mechanism, and future public leaders, future public administrators are going to be using TIF. And I think it's important for them to know what's working and what's not, the advantages and disadvantages of this important tool.
Would it be wise to do a report for the whole state?
Yeah, I think so. And there are a couple of different reports that are out there. I think in Madison, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, or COWS, has done a report. I did a report back in 2009 with the Public Policy Forum that analyzes TIF statewide. And I think it's important to keep an eye on this so that it's not being overused, that we're not putting our communities at risk. I'd love to expand the scope of the report to a statewide audience, yeah.
And apart from students in a class who are going to be tomorrow's leaders, how can current communities use this in the future?
That's one of the things that we wanted to highlight in the report, not only the trends of TIF use in the region, but also strategies that elected officials can use to make TIF more successful. So the first thing I think that we thought of was that county governments can provide a lot of technical, financial, and planning assistance to local communities that are looking at TIF, just to put a little more scrutiny on these TIF proposals, thinking about worst-case scenarios. I think what a lot of the plans do is consider best-case scenarios. And I think that elected officials can make better choices with respect to TIF if they know the full story. Another thing is to look at TIF from a regional perspective. I know that communities are competing with one another for jobs and economic growth in their communities, but I think we need to think about TIF a little more regionally. We need to make sure that we're not just poaching jobs from another community by using TIF. We're not using TIF to compete with one another, but rather we're looking at real job creation. And I think the last thing is to look at creative alternatives like reverse TIFs to minimize the risk that these local communities are taking upon themselves. So using all of those strategies, I think we might use TIF in a better way and one that has more efficient returns.
John Kuvari is a political science professor at UW-La Crosse. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis talked with him about a recent report UW-La Crosse and UW Extension produced that looks at regional tax incremental finance district use in the greater La Crosse area. Kuvari is the lead author of that report. A copy of the report is available on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. And next time on Newsmakers, we'll preview a conference in La Crosse next month that deals with the issue of human trafficking. The conference is sponsored by the La Crosse YWCA. We'll also talk with an expert on human trafficking from a California-based agency that works to stop incidents of human trafficking around the world. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroub, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews and photos, and if you'd like to comment on our program or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook, updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.